Okay, should we make a start, please? Thank you. I'm sorry that some of you, I did order about 150 copies of the handout, which I think went out last week, and there's a few more I've handed out this week. Has anyone got any spare? Are there any spare handouts knocking around anywhere? There's a one, two. If people who don't have one could kind of three, there's one up there, one down here, one over here. Otherwise, if you could kind of make do and share for now, and I'll make sure that Jeremy puts some on the table just outside the English office from tomorrow. Okay, right. In this lecture, I'm going to consider Edward Thomas from two different angles. The first angle, from the perspective of modernity and modernism, which is one of those themes that will keep cropping up as you go through this course. The second, from the perspective of writer and nation. So angle one, modernity and modernism. Angle two, writer and nation. And that's going to broadly structure the lecture. And these two themes, as I say, keep cropping up through literature in the modern world. Brief bit of biography about Edward Thomas. He was born in 1878 in London, went to a grammar school there, then Oxford University from 1897 to 1900, and became a London-based freelance writer slash literary journalist, which he did for 15 years before joining the British Army in 1915 and then dying in the First World War in April 1917. Although he's famous for his poetry, he also wrote 38 books of prose, including a novel, some literary criticism, some biographies, poetry anthologies, travel books, sketches. And this was his kind of bread and butter for 15 years before he turned to poetry at the age of 36 in November 1914. And he wrote 144 poems really fast over the next 2 years. And then he obviously died, as I say, in April 1917. I suppose the only point to take from this is the fact that in studying his poetry, you're studying a tiny fraction of his output, and really the only bit that's received any critical attention. The rest of it has just kind of wasted away in library archives for the last 100 years. Right, so let's look at it through from the perspective of modernity and modernism, first of all. So I'm going to digress a little bit and talk a little bit about modernity in this period. Some critics, and I think Jeremy mentioned last week, that many ages have seen themselves as modern, and that the term should therefore be seen as a relative one. Every age is modern unto itself, that kind of argument. I would argue, however, that at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries, in Western Europe and North America, society went through changes that were unprecedented and different in scale to anything that had gone before. So by describing the modernity of this period, we're describing something new and of a different order to what had happened before. So in other words, change happened faster, more radically than it had before, and it changed more aspects of society. So, for example, in science, you've got Einstein's special theory of relativity, which is a lot earlier than people tend to think. It was discovered in 1905, or created in 1905. The atom, the structure of the atom was discovered in 1913, and the atom was first split in 1918. So this is nearly 100 years ago. 27 years after that, we have the first dropping of the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima. So within 27 years, not that long, we go from splitting the atom to dropping atomic bombs, developing knowledge of weapons that could potentially destroy human life on Earth. In technology, you've got the first radio contact across the Atlantic in 1901, the invention of a vacuum cleaner in 1901 as well. 1903, you've got the first flight by the Wright brothers. In 1909, a mere 6 years later, people are flying across the channel. In 1914, so only 11 years after the first tentative flight, you've got planes being used extensively to bomb the other side in the First World War. So I suppose the point I'm trying to get across is that change happened rapidly, and it really fundamentally challenged people's ideas about what being a human being meant. Britain by 1900 was the first predominantly urban society in the world. London was by then the most populous city on the planet, but a better example of the scale of the changes that people had undergone in a relatively short period of time is given by the Welsh capital, Cardiff. In 1800, it wasn't the Welsh capital. There was no Welsh capital. It was a village of 1,600 people. But by 1900, thanks to the development of mining in the Welsh valleys, it was the busiest industrial port in the world, with a population of 170,000. Further changes. In 1909, there's the first mass-produced car, Ford Model T. In 1900, the British Labour Party was founded. By 1924, was forming its first government. In 1906, the movement for women's suffrage, the Vote for Women, became prominent for the first time. And in 1920, even Oxford University took its first woman student. Although it's interesting, the last college to do so held out until 1985. In 1928, women won the right to vote. There were also campaigns which resulted in the achievement of old age pensions, some kind of healthcare, at least in Britain, if not the United States, and the minimum wage came in this period. In international terms, there's the scramble for Africa. So in the final decades of the 19th century, the European powers divided Africa among themselves in order to exploit its resources for their growing industries. So on the one hand, you've got this frantic colonial scramble, and on the other, you've got signs of the end of empire, idea that the British Empire had reached its peak and was in decline. So after centuries of oppression in Ireland, the British sort of finally gave up their hold on the south of Ireland, at least, after a bitter war of independence, which ended in 1921. So again, this is the first sign of one of the themes that will come up again with writers on this course, the decline of European imperial powers, and that the formerly oppressed peoples are kind of reasserting their own cultural and sometimes political independence. And this is a theme which comes up again on the course, and which is still relevant to writers today. In cultural terms, you've got, in 1896, the launch of the Daily Mail, the first halfpenny paper, which was the precursor of the tabloid, aimed at working and lower middle class people who, thanks to the Education Act of 1870, which mandated every child under the age of 11 to go to school, meant that there was a working class readership for the first time in history. In the same period, in the last decade of the 19th century, thanks to advances in industrial printing, you've got the beginning of the literary market as we know it today, with literature, or high-quality literary material at one end, and popular fiction at the other. So although the Daily Mail was founded in this period, you've also got the Times Literary Supplement being founded. You've got the beginnings of a difference between the popular market, the mass market, and the literary quality market, which we're familiar with from authors today. And this started in the 1880s, 1890s. This is the beginnings of what we know of as modernity. There's also a massive increase in the sheer amount of material that's around, literary material around. For example, in 1880, there were 2,868 journal and magazine titles published. But by 1900, there were 4,799. So it's basically doubled in 20 years. In 1886, 900 new novels a year. In 1914, over 1,600. So this massive growth in a short space of time caused anxieties for the British establishment, who mainly worried that ordinary people, having been taught to read for the first time, were not reading the right stuff. They were reading tabloid newspapers and halfpenny newspapers instead of the broadsheets, and they were reading bestsellers instead of the high literary quality material that would have educated them properly. Also, new forms of culture were beginning to emerge. Famously, cinema in 1906. The first feature film was released. So there's a sense for the establishment that all this technology and all this opening up of a working class market, that culture is getting a little bit out of control. It's not the kind of coterie that it used to be in the high Victorian period. So I suppose I've digressed a little bit, and this is a taste of the changes that are coined in the term modernity. And these changes, I suppose, if you're looking for a sort of historical point where they come to a head, would be the First World War, obviously lasting from 1914 to 1918. There were 70 million people joined up or were conscripted into various armies at the time, and 15 million people were killed. So all the industrial and technological capacities of modernity were turned into the prosecution of war, with the result, as we know, that men and women were killed more efficiently and in greater numbers and in more modern ways than ever before. So turning quickly to modernism, which is a term which is more tricky to define, basically you could argue that modernism refers to the groups of artists, musicians, and writers who responded to all the changes of modernity, and especially to World War I, by advocating a break from traditional ways of organizing or forming art, music, and literature. So the old forms, the old subject matters, no longer captured what it meant to live in such a radically different world. And so modern artists tried to radically adapt old traditions and forms, or replace them with new ones, in order to adequately express their circumstances in this changed world, or to jolt people into thinking differently about the world around them. And modernists often formed these small groups, them against the rest of the bourgeois world, and gave themselves a name. So you heard last week of the Dadaists that Jeremy mentioned, and another group, this time based in England, were the Vorticists. And they were one of the most radical modernist groups in Britain, either before or after the First World War. And they published a magazine called Blast in 1914 and again in 1915. And one of its pages is on the handout. So if you look at part one of the handout, you've got page one from the magazine Blast. And you can see from it immediately that it's not a traditional poem. It's got the heading, Blast First from Politeness, England. And it's not a traditional poem, obviously. It plays around with layout. Do we read it from left to right and down, or do we look at it and let the words with the bigger font size catch our eye first? If we do that, then the word England probably catches our eye. But it's kind of taken out of its usual contexts. For example, the 1,000-mile-long body of water from the Floridas, which makes us mild, might be the Gulf Stream. So England is placed geographically, I suppose, in this, but it's placed in an unconventional way. The word blast perhaps alludes to the war, certainly alludes to the war, published in 1914-15, and seems to be used to deride England, too. The 1,000-mile-long, 2-kilometre-deep thing also suggests some kind of fantastical trench. And again, the war. There are also allusions to other allusions to modernity. There's the London Colosseum. There's a socialist playwright, a chorus girl, vast machinery to produce. The reader is bombarded with aspects of modernity that she can't make sense of. They just come at you as a reader, and you make of them what you will. And is this a reflection of the fragmented, chaotic, modern life in the very form of the poem? Maybe. There are jarring nouns and adjectives too. I mean, how can mountains, for example, be officious? So in these ways, the poem, I think, is self-conscious about its use, if it's a poem, is self-conscious about its use of language. It problematizes the sort of easy communication between writer and reader, forcing readers to become aware that they're constructing meaning in the act of reading, rather than simply receiving the writer's intended meaning. Moreover, there is no identifiable speaker, no I voice. Instead, there are institutions and machines and bodiless objects which seem to be speaking to us. And again, this was, after all, the age in which the human voice first left the human body for the first time. So it was the time when it first became possible to record the human voice. So for the first time, voices came out of things that weren't bodies that were standing in front of you, human beings that were standing in front of you. The phonograph was invented in this period, the precursor of the record player, CD player, iPod thing. So again, it was, if you think about growing up in that world where any time you hear a human voice, there is a human being within earshot that is projecting his or her voice towards you, it must come as a massive shock to suddenly be faced with a machine and a voice, a human voice, coming out of a machine for the first time. And it's very hard for us to read what that must be like, because we're immersed in it, we've grown up in it. So it's very hard for us to kind of put ourselves back in the shoes of someone at that time. So BLAST, I suppose, is an attempt to find new forms which begin to capture the confusion, the shock, the exhilaration, the newness of this modernity, this revolution in society. At the other end of the scale, you've got your traditional practitioners of poetry which are still turning out their verses. An example of this would be In Time of the Breaking of Nations by Thomas Hardy, which is also on your handout. This is also written in 1915, so it's the same year as BLAST. Only a man harrowing clods in a slow, silent walk with an old horse that stumbles and nods, half asleep as they stalk. Only thin smoke without flame from the heaps of couch grass. Yet this will go on with the same, though dynasties pass. Yonder a maid and her white come whispering by. War's annals will cloud into night ere their story die. So the form is traditional, obviously. Alternate lines of 8 and 5 or 6 syllables in quatrains. You've got an A-B-A-B rhyme scheme. And the use of archaisms like white to mean man. A slightly awkward word order and choice. For example, yet this will go on with the same, which is done in order to meet the rhyme scheme. The poem is basically fairly reassuring to its readers. It seems to suggest that, yes, war will break nations, but these big dynastic changes have always happened in history. Modernity is nothing new. Rather, modernity itself is put into a kind of reassuring, classical, dynastic view of history in which basically nothing fundamentally has changed. And this classical view is epitomized by the relation of the peasant to the land. And Hardy seems to be saying that, or the poem seems to be saying that this will always go on in some kind of organic whole. Young men and women, similarly, will always fall in love. And these things are eternal truths which will outlive the changes brought by modernity or brought by war. Okay, so I've kind of taken a bit of time to give you a brief context for definitions of modernity, modernism, and a little bit of a context for what is happening at the time when Thomas started writing poetry. As I say, most of Thomas's poetry was written in 1915, and I want to try and fit his poetry into this picture of traditional on the one hand and radically modernist on the other. So if we look at the poem As the Team's Head Brass, which is in direct dialogue with Hardy's poem. Again, it's on your handout. I think I put it on the back. Is that right? And it's on page 115 of that green collected, if you've got the book with you. Okay, so as I read this through, I want you to think about ways in which it's in dialogue with Hardy's poem. Maybe ways in which it might be a bit more challenging as well, ways in which it is actually not as straightforwardly traditional as it first appears, perhaps. So as the team's head brass flashed out on the turn, the team's head brass is basically a ploughing machine, traditional ploughing machine, pulled by a horse, normally with two or three ploughmen in attendance. So it's quite a traditional vision of the English-British countryside. As the team's head brass flashed out on the turn, the lovers disappeared into the wood. I sat among the boughs of the fallen elm that strewed an angle of the fallow and watched the plough narrowing a yellow square of charlock. Every time the horses turned, instead of treading me down, the ploughman leaned upon the handles to say or ask a word about the weather, next about the war. Scraping the share, he faced towards the wood and screwed along the furrow till the brass flashed once more. The blizzard felled the elm whose crest I sat in by a woodpecker's round hole. The ploughman said, "When will they take it away?" "When the war's over." So the talk began, 1 minute and an interval of 10, a minute more and the same interval. "Have you been out?" "No." "And don't want to, perhaps?" "I could spare an arm. I shouldn't want to lose a leg. If I should lose my head, why so, I should want nothing more." "Have many gone from here?" "Yeah." "Many lost?" "Yes, a good few. Only two teams work on the farm this year. One of my mates is dead. The second day in France they killed him. It was back in March, the very night of the blizzard too. Now if he had stayed here, we should have moved the tree, and I should not have sat here. Everything would have been different, for it would have been another world. Aye, and a better, though if we could see all might seem good." Then the lovers came out of the wood again, the horses started, and for the last time I watched the clods crumble and topple over after the ploughshare and the stumbling team. So obviously there are lots of examples of kind of traditional kind of rhyming verse kind of thing in here. You've got your blank verse form, lines of about 10 syllables, five stresses, rural setting. It doesn't directly address any of the big changes of modernity that are happening in Thomas's world. It seems quite escapist, I suppose. And like the Hardy poem, there's a ploughman, there are lovers, and it's an identifiable speaker. I suppose you can paraphrase the poem, which you can't do with the blast piece. And it seems to be the whole thing seems to be premised on an agreed world which is out there, which an author can communicate to us, its readers. But there are other ways, I think, in which the poem is not straightforwardly traditional. So unlike the Hardy poem, for example, in Thomas's poem, the lovers are a bit more ambiguous. We all know why they disappear into the wood, but their relationship is juxtaposed against the war. And their relationship, for example, might not outlast that war. Maybe they're disappearing into the wood because they're about to be separated. Perhaps one is going off to fight or work in the factory. The Hardy poem, moreover, specifies the gender of the two lovers, a maid and her man. But the Thomas poem has two men talking together of the war, one of them elegizing his dead mate, and then identifies two more people as lovers. So it's a bit more ambiguous. They seem to have a physical relationship which is a bit more casual than that of Hardy's maid and her white. And we don't know whether they're male or female. So Thomas's poem perhaps is beginning to register that war changes the relations of the sexes, that even something which we think of as intrinsic or above history is in fact dependent on events of history. History or war changes the way that men relate to men, women to women, women to men, and so on. And so in this way, perhaps, the poem is beginning to register something of modernity. Another way in which the poem is not traditional is in what it implies about man's relation to the land. So Hardy's poem implies that man's organic relation to the land will always continue. But Thomas's poem depicts how this is just not the case. The land is already changed by the war. There are only two plough teams this year, and this particular plough team is reduced to one man. His mate has died at the front. The tree that the speaker sits on would not have been there if the war wasn't going on. And the closing lines, image of the speaker watching for the last time the clods crumble and topple over, implies correctly, as it turns out, that this rural way of life is coming to an end. So in a sense, Thomas comes at modernity from a funny angle. He's trying to write a traditional poem about the experience of an individual speaker in the English countryside, but in a sense, the poem fails. In a sense, what the poem does is capture how things that were traditionally thought of as eternal, man's relation to nature, the lover's story, are also subject to history. So Thomas's poetry in this sense is the kind of subconscious last throw of the traditional dice. You could even argue that in this poem, Thomas stretches the traditional form to breaking point. For example, the rhythm of the dialogue is in contrast to the stresses imparted by the poem's form. That bit where the two men are in intermittent dialogue with each other every time the ploughman comes back, and then there's a long gap, and then they exchange a few words. At this section of the poem, you've got the rhythms of the vernacular voices, which effectively establish one rhythm, and then you've got the expected rhythm, which comes from the iambic rhythm of the blank verse. And these two clash. And it leads to some odd line breaks, like if at the end of one line and he at the beginning of the next, or everything at the end of one line and would at the beginning of the next. So it's as if the dialogue and the vernacular speech injects a rhythm into the poem which its traditional form struggles to contain. And perhaps the logical next step is to break the traditional form more completely, something that you will consider when you look at some of the more openly modernist poems, openly modernist writers like Eliot, Carlos Williams, in the next few weeks. So the imagery, too, suggests a world that's turned upside down. The blizzard can be read literally, or as a symbol of the changes caused by war or modernity, while the speaker finds himself in the strange place of the elm tree's crest next to a woodpecker's round hole. So in other words, these changed times place images that would normally have been in their rightful places instead kind of jarring next to each other. The speech also reveals the ploughman's black humour. If I should lose my head, hints at the mental state likely to be caused by becoming a soldier at the front, but it also works on a literal level too, alluding to that kind of macabre death in the trenches in which the body is decapitated or whatever. So the black humour deepens with the phrase, I should want nothing more. And on the one level, that's nothing more I want. I want to die for king and country. Literally, obviously, when he's dead, he won't want anything. He won't want for anything when he's dead, either. So this kind of black humour is there, which there's a critic called Paul Fussell. He's written a book called The Great War and Modern Memory, who I think the details I put on the handout, he argues that this kind of black humour became part of British culture from the First World War onwards. Tim Armstrong is another interesting critic on this kind of thing. He looks at the relationship between modernism and the body and war in Modernism, Technology and the Body, also on your handout. So an activity that you might like to do in your seminars would be to take any of the Thomas poems and consider how it fits into this picture of traditional poetry on the one hand and how it begins to show more modernist tendencies on the other. And you can do this with virtually any of Thomas's poems. Okay, I'm going to turn now to part two, the idea of the writer and nation. As I said earlier, one of the key themes is of literature in the 20th century is the emergence of different national literatures in English. Writers from many nations once colonized by the British established cultural, political independence. And this process of writing as a member of a colonized nation, or writing as a member of a nation in which there are political issues with the colonizer, which is most of them, if not all of them, throws up all sorts of issues for writers from nations which are dominated by a colonial power, especially for those who are writing in English, which is traditionally the language of the colonizer. This is a big issue for lots of writers. James Joyce is the classic example, I suppose, who you'll come across later in the course. Edward Thomas is normally seen as an example of a good Englishman. Lots of critics call him a quintessentially English poet because they associate his writing with the rural depictions of the rural English countryside, and then they relate the fact that he was prepared to die as a soldier in the First World War to his representation of the English countryside. And they kind of make the connection between the two. So his poetry has actually often been used as a recruiting sergeant for soldiers, particularly in the Second World War. Here is a man who knew the beauty of the English countryside so much and felt it so strongly that he thought it was worth joining the British Army and dying for. This is the kind of the ideology behind a lot of the critical work on Thomas in the 20th century. And if you want to kind of read those sort of takes, they're worth reading. You should look at Edna Longley's work in particular. And there's Poetry in the Wars is a collection of essays that she has written along those lines. I think there's two copies in the library. If you want to find something online, Warwick University subscribes to the Cambridge Companions online, which is a really good resource. And as Jeremy said, I've just moved to Swansea, and they don't do it there. And it's a really great resource for people at Warwick. Cambridge Companions online. If you just go to the library catalogue and look there, you've got Cambridge Companions to Joyce, to Yeats, to based most of the canonical writers. Cambridge Companion to the Literature of the First World War. There's an essay by Edna Longley in there where she comes out with this kind of Thomas as the quintessential English poet, connecting him to the First World War and so on. And you can all read it at the same time if you want to, because it's available online. It's really useful. Anyway, another writer who thinks about Thomas along these lines is Andrew Motion, the ex-poet laureate. What I want to do in the remainder of this lecture is the last 10 minutes, is complicate this picture a little bit. And I want to suggest that Thomas might be read as a pioneering writer of an English language literature from Wales, so a Welsh English language literature. So a little bit of introduction first. In 1894, in his journal Wales, the writer Owen M. Edwards, who was a key figure in the Welsh literary revival, Thomas's history tutor at Oxford, called for, it's on your handout again, that's quote number one, a literature that will be English in language and Welsh in spirit. An early definition of Welsh writing in English. And this echoes a similar movement that is happening in Ireland at the same time, where you've got the poet W.B. Yeats calling on writers to build up a national tradition, a national literature, which shall be nonetheless Irish in spirit from being English in language. And their idea was that you can build a political nation, but you build it culturally first of all. So you create a literature which is distinctly Irish or distinctly Welsh, and you make people realise their Welshness or their Irishness, and then political change follows. That's the kind of, broadly speaking, the kind of idea. And there is some evidence that Thomas responded to this call. His quote two, I think, 1901 letter to Edwards, where he writes, he congratulates Edwards' book on Welsh history, and he says, "I'm sure that because I am Welsh, you would be glad to know how much I love the book." And this is possibly significant, because he's basically identifying himself as a Welshman. I am Welsh. And the letter goes on. "Edward's book compelled me to wish that my small activities were usefully connected to Wales, and Thomas asks Edwards to suggest any kind of work to help you and the Welsh cause. And this is hardly surprising. Again, Thomas was born in 1878 in London, but he was born to Welsh parents. He was the first generation of his family not to be born in Wales, and the first generation not to speak Welsh as a first language. So he frequently visited family in Welsh-speaking areas of Wales, just outside Swansea, and as well as a Welsh-speaking community in Wiltshire, in Swindon, which is long since gone. Some of his best friends, colleagues, were Welsh-language poets, and many of Thomas's books written during those 15 years as a freelance writer were about Wales or written in Wales. There's one book called Beautiful Wales, published in 1905, where he writes, "I do not believe in patriotism unless I am in Wales." He often criticises Britain or England. In one review of Irish poetry, he refers to Irish poets who sing of Ireland herself with an intimate reality often missing from English patriotic poetry, where Britannia is a frigid personification. In a review of the Dublin Book of Irish Verse, also on your handout, he describes Irish writing in English as work which is, in a real sense, foreign, though written in English, and declares his interest in the process by which English is used as a foreign tongue by writers who were born to it. It's a weird phrase. English is used as a foreign tongue by writers who were born to it. So he describes how writers who have not... The paradoxical notion that English for some writers is both a first and a foreign language means that there are some writers who have not a medium perfectly and by long traditional use adapted to their modes of feeling and thought. So there's something about him being Welsh, which means that although even though his first language is English, it doesn't necessarily mean that he can fully express his identity or something about himself because it's another person's language or another nation's language. There's a slight mismatch between his identity as a Welshman and the language through which he has to express it. Again, similar themes emerge later in the course with people like Joyce and Gugi and so on. There's a few of them. Okay, Thomas also wrote for the London-based papers. At this time, it was not possible to make a living as a literary journalist in Wales. But he also went back across to Wales and wrote pieces for, even though he didn't make his living there, he wrote pieces for Cardiff-based journals, including one called The Welsh Nationalist. There's a story, The Patriot, which is on your handout too, in which he describes a British soldier dying abroad. And this soldier's final moments are juxtaposed against the soldier's memory of his childhood, a visit to Wales from London, where he lives in exile. And the dying soldier remembers his father singing the songs of his country, meeting people who were talking in the tongue in which his father used to sing, i.e. Welsh, and carrying a proud freight of living men looking ahead towards their country. So the tragedy on the soldier's deathbed is that he realizes that the country that he had been fighting for was not the land of his father and of his father's fathers and of those who sang the same songs. His country was not the country he had fought for. And this story, which is published, we should remember, in The Welsh Nationalist, suggests that Welsh interests are not best served by fighting imperialist battles for another country, i.e. Britain. Okay, well, this is all very well, but how does it inform the poetry? Let's think about the literature. And I think I want to argue that it makes his poetry, this Welshness makes his poetry a bit more subversive of England and Britain. And also there are examples of how he positively imports Welsh language meters, forms Welsh folk stories into this English language tradition. Examples of the poetry's subversion of England and Britain, if you look at the poem No One Cares Less Than I, which is on your handout, also on page 115 of the collected, the green collected by R. George Thomas. No one cares less than I, nobody knows but God, whether I am destined to lie under a foreign clod, or the words I made to the bugle call in the morning. but laughing, storming, scorning, only the bugles know what the bugles say in the morning. And they do not care when they blow the call that I heard and made words to early this morning. This is a poem written in May 1916, 1 year into his career as a soldier, and it's a parody of Rupert Brooke's 1914 sonnet, The Soldier, which is more famous, and which Brooke famously writes, there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England, and in which Brooke's own death, or the speaker in Brooke's poems' own death as a soldier, is subject to an imagined future in which he is remembered with honour and his burial place abroad is seen as a little spot of England. So Brooke's ability, in Brooke's poem, his ability to manage to imagine the future is used by him as a way of encouraging present action, as a way of encouraging people to fight for king and country, and so on. And Thomas's poem, in a way, rejects this. It focuses on an early morning call to parade, a sort of ritualized moment at the beginning of the soldier's day, where the individual men are brought together and have their group identity as British soldiers reinforced or reasserted. And I think that the poem explodes that particular myth, and in doing so, it explicitly connects the sort of failure of the future to a British national identity. It presents a sort of bleak view of time. The future is unknowable to the speaker, and he cannot imagine a posterity from which he can look back at the present moment and make it okay, unlike Brooke. There is only the speaker's alienation and the words he forms in answer to his predicament, and words which have absolutely no impact on that predicament. So in that sense, the purpose of communication is held up to scrutiny. He is speaking to himself. His words are drowned out by a national ritual which is indifferent towards his words. Okay, very quickly, you might also look at Home 3, also on the handout, page 104 of The Green Collected. And this poem presents a political angle on the notion of home. The speaker describes the moment when one of a group of British soldiers on a day's walk away from their army camp mentions the word home. The word home raised a smile in us all three, and one repeated it, smiling just so that all knew what he meant and none would say. Between three countries far apart that lay, we were divided and looked strangely each at the other. And we knew we were not friends, but fellows in a union that ends with the necessity for it, as it ought. So clearly subverting any illusion of a sense of home shared by three soldiers, rejecting this sort of big wartime propaganda that they were all subject to, that attempted to unite the three of them in the sort of national British cause. Insisting instead that each soldier's understanding of home comes from each of the three countries they come from. And the word union is also, in the context of the time, politically charged word to use. The poem was written just after Easter 1916, and big event happened in Dublin. The Easter Rising happened in 1916 in Easter. A group of Irish nationalists declared independence from Britain, an event which led to the successful Irish War of Independence 3 years later. And what's also less known is that there were anti-war uprisings in Glasgow at the time, and there was anger in Wales as well, which I'll come to in a minute. I think the leader of Plaid Cymru, about 20 years later, ended up bombing an RAF base somewhere in Wales as a sign of his disinclination to be British. Anyway, so prior to the outbreak of the First World War in 1914, war in Ulster seemed a likely prospect. So the breakup of the Union must have seemed even more likely in the aftermath of the battles in Dublin, Glasgow in 1916. So that line, the union that ends with the necessity for it, recognises possibly the likely end of the political union, and also in the sense that men brought momentarily together as soldiers would also be demobbed and their personal union would break. So again, perhaps an activity you could do in your seminars would be to look at any poem's presentation of England and Britain. And how those poems are either patriotic, or subversive in their presentation. You might like to square what I've just told you about Thomas's Welshness and his sympathies for the Welsh cause with what seemed to be fairly patriotic English or British poems somewhere in some of the poems in the collection. How can you square those two? Is there a reading you can make which allows for both? I suppose good poems to look at here would be The Coombe, would be one. Another poem called Tears. Another poem called In Memoriam. Another activity you could do would be to compare Brooke's poem The Soldier, which I think I put on the handout, to Thomas's, the one I read out, No One Cares Less Than I. And finally, the second aspect of Thomas and national identity is the way that his Welshness comes into the poems and his use of Welsh metres, forms and folk stories. It's as if he's coming into the English language as an outsider. A couple of quick examples. There is a tradition in Welsh language poetry called Englyn Indol Union, which is basically a fairly complicated Welsh form that Thomas adapts into English in a poem called Head and Bottle. So if you look on your, I think I've put the first two lines on your handout. And the first two lines are, the downs will lose the sun, white alism lose the bee's hum. And here, this is a classic example of this Welsh form. We've got a 10-syllable line followed by a 4, and this pattern is repeated through the poem. The sixth syllable of the first line, sun, half rhymes with the end rhyme, end word in that line, sum. And the pattern of consonants in the second half of the first line, the LZM of alism, is copied in the first part of the second line, the LZM of lose the bee's hum. This is a, Welsh poetry is notorious for its really strict insistence on numbers of syllables and repetition of consonants or vowel sounds across lines. And it can be no coincidence that Thomas is importing one of these Welsh language forms into English poetry here. Again, it's something that Edna Longley and the critics who are quite keen to just make him as an archetypal English poet just misses. It is very complicated stuff, I suppose. If you're bilingual, are there any Welsh people, anybody from Wales in the room? Two, three, okay, excellent. Well, if there are any bilingual speakers here, people who are keen, it's all laid out quite clearly, Welsh language forms, in the Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetics, which you can get in the bookshop or in the library. And you can just kind of read through some of them and apply them to Welsh and Thomas's poetry and see if there's any crossover. There's also another book by Mayek Stevens, which I think I've put on your handout, which gives you a really good summary of some of those forms as well. Uses Welsh folk traditions. A poem called The Ash Grove, which is on your handout, page 98 of The Green Collected, talks about a patriotic Welsh folk song. The Song of the Ash Grove is a Welsh folk song. So the Song of the Ash Grove, soft as love uncrossed, and then in a crowd or in distance it were lost. But that moment unveiled something unwilling to die, and I had what most I desired without search or desert or cost. The Song of the Ashgrove is, as I said, Llwyn On, pardon my pronunciation, a Welsh harp tune, the most popular version of which was first written in the 1860s, and the first lines of which read, "All hail to you, Wales, the land of my fathers, I would make you immortal in song." And the poem is written in an adapted Welsh metre, the triban, a four-line stanza in an AABA rhyming pattern. So the uncrossed, lost, die, cost, the AABA rhyming pattern, in which the end word of the third line, die, is echoed in both the I and desired before the caesura in the fourth line. So again, it's another little example of how a Welsh form creeps into Thomas's translations into English. So, an activity you could do if you want to go down this route is you could search for other examples of Welsh folk stories, other examples of Welsh forms in some of the poetry in the course. To do that, you would need the Princeton Encyclopedia, as I say, or Meic Stephen's Guide to the Literature of Wales. I'm going to stop there. Thank you very much. All right. Actually, I do have some. Sorry, I've got one or two copies of the handout. I've got two, if anyone wants.